Are we ready? I'm Alan Day. I was born on a ranch in southeast Arizona that my grandfather established in 1880. And I guess I always felt that I had ranching in my blood. So when I got out of college, I went back to Lazy V and became active in Lazy V. My dad was still there, but I became active. And as time went on, I expanded, and I bought a ranch in the Sand Hills of Nebraska near Whitman, and then by chance bought a ranch just north of that in South Dakota, and so was a rancher for 50 years and loved ranching and was active hands-on rancher, was not an absentee owner, but I was a rancher slash cowboy slash manager.
Well, and you bought a third ranch. What prompted you to do that?
The fellow that sold me, that was the agent that sold me the Nebraska ranch, called me and said, the Nebraska ranch is a good ranch, but the better ranch is north of there, and this is an amazing ranch, and I want to show it to you. And I said, well, Joe, no, I'm full of ranches right now. I have two of them that I'm the active manager, and I'm full up to the brim, and I don't want any more ranches, can't handle another one. But he wouldn't leave me alone, and he kept calling, and he said, you need to come see this ranch. You'll be amazed. And so finally I agreed to go look, mainly just to keep him from calling me all the time. And so we met at Ninzel, Nebraska, and then the ranch road is 10 miles from there north into South Dakota. And as I was going down the ranch road, I had a feeling that I've never had in my life before. And that feeling was I'd been there in some other time in my life, or another life, if you would. But I knew what was around the next bend. I knew what I was going to see. And I just felt like I was coming home. And so by the time I got to the headquarters, I was hooked. I had somehow had been on that ranch before in another life or another time, or and had never been there to my knowledge. It just I had the knowledge of what the ranch was. And so when I got out of the car, I didn't tell Joe that, but I had already made up my mind. Whatever I have to do, I need to tie on to this ranch. I need to be a part of this ranch.
The item of the Wild Horse Sanctuary, was that the ranch then where you began the Wild Horse Sanctuary? Tell me about that.
Yes, it was. I had some partners in the ranching enterprise that we did, and I called them and I said, boy, we have enough ranches. However, I've fallen in love with this ranch, and can we borrow enough money to buy this ranch? And for some reason, they trusted me, and they said, yes, if you think it's a good ranch and you want to buy it, then fine, we'll extend the credit and we'll go. But then I frightened myself because the Nebraska ranch had 2,500 mother cows and calves, really nice red Angus cows. And the Arizona ranch had 1,500 mother cows and calves. And I thought, well, wow, I sure have a lot of eggs in that one basket. You know, I'm a rancher and I'm all cows and calves. And the cow market can change, and it might be smart not to have all your eggs in one basket. In other words, not to have three clones, three ranches that were the same. So I started trying to think of ways to be productive on that ranch and to make it an active ranch, but not with cows and calves, you know, some other form of use. And then kind of by chance, I came across the concept, the idea that the Bureau of Land Management had these excess wild horses. They were excess unadoptable wild horses, and they didn't know what to do with them, so they had them in feedlots, and they were just paying the the feedlot operator to feed him with no goal, you know, it was just a warehousing facility. So I got interested in that because the first horse I ever rode was a wild horse, was a little horse that had been captured out of a wild horse herd, and Chico raised me, and I just had always been fascinated with wild horses. So put together a plan, had a partner in the planning, Dayton Hyde, who is a quite well-known advocate for wild horses. And we went to the Bureau of Land Management and said, we'll take all of your excess unadoptable horses and we'll put them back out on range. And the range that we have is just the most marvelous grassland you'll ever see. And so the horses will be able to run on the ranch in a pretty much free fashion. Sure, we'll have them fenced all the way around the outside, but we'll move them around on the ranch and they'll be out there on wonderful grass and far happier than they would be in the feedlots and at a lot less cost to the government. And darned if we didn't sell that concept. And the Congress and the Bureau of Land Management said, well, we think it's a good idea. So they gave us a contract to take those 1,500, actually it was 1,800 wild horses. Dayton took 300 on his place over near the Black Hills. And I took 1,500 on the Mustang Meadow Ranch.
Well, what was your goal with these horses? What did you want to accomplish?
Well, my ranching all starts with the grass, and so I wanted to. The ranch was kind of run down, and the previous owner had not treated it with respect, and I study grass, and I try to understand what makes grass happy, you know, what makes grass flourish and be happy. So I wanted to do some activity on the ranch that would enhance the grass. And so I studied the wild horses and their grazing habits and what all, and they're pretty tough customers. They're grazing, they bite straight down on the grass, and then they yank on it when they bite it, and if the grass isn't pretty firmly rooted, they'll literally pull up the grass plant. And their hoof action is actually harder on ground than cattle hoof action. So I had to, plan the ranching, the grazing system and the ranching so that the horses would not be damaged, but rather graze in a way that would make the grass flourish. And so I told the Bureau of Land Management when I took the contract, I said, look, I'm really watching this land and this grass, and if I can't make it better with the horses on it, then you're going to have to take the horses back because the land is not going to go downhill on my watch. That's the bottom line here. That's not going to happen. And so that's the way we went about it, and I took those. The goal for the horses was to make the horses as free as they could be and put them on wonderful feed where they could just, you know, live out their life. It was really an old horse retirement home. The Bureau of Land Management owned the horses. They had no goals for the horses. They were excess. They couldn't turn them back in Nevada on the ranges or wherever they gathered them because those ranges were already up to capacity. And so we just had an old horse retirement home there. And our goal was to make those horses as happy as they could be until they lived their life out.
Were there any horses appropriate to be matched up with people? In other words, was adoption ever part of your goal?
Well, the Bureau of Land Management had previously sorted the horses, and the adoptable ones they went a different direction with. And then these were the culls. They were the one-eyed ones, the crippled ones, the old ones, the mean ones, the otherwise unadoptable horses. But were there some good horses in there? Yes. Did we break a few of them and ride them and make friends with them? You bet we did. But the Bureau had classified them as unadoptable. And so they didn't, by anything we did, they didn't raise up another level and get in the adoption category. They were still the, you know, the unwanted, unloved horses.
So what is it like now? Tell me about, bring us up to date. What's it like today?
The ranch or the horse system or what's, I'd be more specific on your question, please.
Sorry about that. Well, that's, first, the horse system. Tell me what's the disposition of the horses now?
Well, the, you're going to the tail end of the book here, and that's okay. The, some people from Oklahoma came up when we had quite a little notoriety with this wild horse herd, and people like to come out, and it's quite a sight to see 1,500 horses in one herd and see them, you know, gallop around and play and things. So some people from Oklahoma came up, and they said, wow, this is really impressive, and this is really neat. We want one of these. And I showed them everything we had and told them, well, you know, here's how I went about it. I went and showed the BLM that we had a wonderful ranch and said, you know, it's suitable for these horses. And so I said, maybe you can do the same. Well, what they did is they went to their representatives in Congress and said, they've got that up in South Dakota. We want you to take it away from South Dakota and give it to us. And so their representatives in Congress had more seniority and higher up in the, you know, the committees and what all, and that's exactly what they did.
So what then fill in, so how are the, fill in a little bit between there then. If I skip to the end of the book, what, in a nutshell, can you tell me what happened in between?
Well, I had never been out on the ground with wild horses on a daily basis, so I had a lot to learn from the wild horses. And also, in order to make my grazing system work properly, I had to be able to be friends with the wild horses, to move them at my will, you know, from pasture to pasture to rest pastures, and bring them into the corrals if we had to give them a shot for worms or, you know, other reasons. So I determined that I had to do a wild horse training program, if you would. Another word for it is horse whisper training on the horses. Monty Roberts coined that term. And so when the horses arrived, their comfort with man was about 2 miles. If you got closer than 2 miles, boy, they'd run off. So my goal was to make them understand that I wasn't their enemy. Man is the biggest enemy of wild horses. We terrorize them. We chase them around with helicopters. We split up their families. We're the worst thing in the wild horse's life. So I had to teach them that I wasn't their enemy, that I was their friend, and that they could trust me. And so we established a training program, and it was wildly successful. In a quite short period of time, the horses accepted me as an alpha male in their midst, and I could get within 10 feet of them, and they would just look at me and say, oh, okay, what do you want now? And so it was amazingly successful. And so one of the parts of the training was I taught them to follow a man on horseback. So when I would ride through a pasture and need to move them to the next pasture to do my rest rotation grazing back to the grass, I would ride through and say, come on, boys, and they'd just fall in behind me, and we'd hit a nice, easy little gallop and into the next pasture. And that was so thrilling. That was the neatest part of my whole life, was making friends with those horses and having them accept me and then say, you know, show us what you want and we'll do it. And so that's the real heart of the book and the real heart of what I did, and the thrilling part. That's why I wrote the book, is being the friend and the mentor and the caregiver for the horses.
Would you do it again?
In a heartbeat. Yes, absolutely. It just, I, you know, horses and dogs are man's friend, and you get a bond with a good dog, you get a bond with a good horse that's just, you almost can't even explain it. It's so strong. And so it was just really neat to be out there with those horses.
What became of the cattle?
Well, when I bought the ranch, I bought it without cattle. And the previous owner had gotten in financial trouble, so one by one he sold all the cows. Every time a bill came up, he'd sell some more cows. So when I arrived, the bank was about to foreclose, and he didn't have any cattle left. So but that ranch, we didn't put any cattle on it till actually the BLM took the sanctuary away from me. Then we put some cattle on there. But the cattle on the other two ranches everything was fine. We ranched and did it successfully for many years.
So now do you actually run cattle, or do you actually run ranches with cattle on them, or others with horses on them?
I no longer do. Fortunately or unfortunately, I have children and I have nieces and nephews, and none of the family was interested in following me into agriculture. And so I was growing older, and I know too many old, bitter ranchers that are kind of trapped there and they can't get out. You know, their kids are doctors or lawyers or not interested in. And the old man ends up 80 and 75 years old and 80 and trying to do the work he could do when he was young. And he's, you know, not a happy camper at that point. And so when the succession wasn't coming along behind me, I said, well, I'm old enough to retire. I'm going to sell the ranches, even though I hate to. It's my heritage and, you know, it's what I love and care about. I'm going to turn a chapter in my life and do other things. And I did.
So you had a bunch of horses. Did you have, and you said they are individuals. Did you have favorites?
Oh yeah, we named a lot of the horses, and when the horses got there, it was really interesting. Whether these were the family groups that they had before they came or not, I have no way of knowing. But they would quickly, when they arrived, they would form a family unit that might be 10, maybe 15, maybe 18 horses. And whenever you'd see them grazing, even in the corral, when you'd bring them in the corral to whatever, feed them in the winter or what all, that group of horses would always be together. And when you'd move them or when you'd stir them up, they might get separated, and in about 4 minutes, they'd all gather back together. And so we'd have the group that's all the red roan mares that are together. And we had some that really stood out. We had two smaller Palomino mares that were twins. I'm sure they were twins. Every marking on them was exactly the same. They were perfectly matched, and they were never 5 feet apart. And they, when they arrived, they were both pregnant. And they had colts on the same day, and the colts looked like twins, and obviously were from the same stallion. And they were born the same day, so we called them the Palomino twins. And we, you know, you'd go out with the horses, and you'd always look for the Palomino twins because they would stand out. And then our most outstanding horse was the biggest horse in the whole herd, and he was a black and white paint. And he never joined a family. There were a few individuals that were just alone, you know, and weren't part of a family group. And we named him Happy, but his black was just as black as you can possibly imagine, and the white was just snow white. And he was this big horse, weighed about 1,400 pounds. And he just stood out, and he was always on the outside of the herd because he wasn't a part of a family group. So he was always on the outside of the herd, so you'd always see him. And we named him Happy. And when you'd go to move the horses, again, he'd be on the outside of the herd. So if you'd look back and you weren't paying attention, well, he'd kind of wander off to the side. And he wasn't trying to run off, but if you didn't pay attention, well, he'd stop down in some draw or low place. and you'd arrive with the horses, and then you'd say, well, where's Happy? And, well, he didn't come. You'd go back and find him, and he'd say, okay, I'll go on and catch up with him. So he was kind of a character. He was so photographic with the black and white that the Bureau of Land Management fell in love with him, too. They told me to gather him one day, which I did. They came with a trailer, and they hauled him up to Flathead Lake, Montana, and put him on a barge and hauled him out to the island that's in Flathead Lake, and they turned him loose on that island. And they said, well, they wanted the fishermen to see a pretty horse. Now, don't ask me who figured that out and why, but that's what happened to Happy.
Hmm.
Strange story, but...
Yeah. So what... Okay. Just also give me, in a nutshell, your relationship with the BLM and how that turned out.
Well, I had dealt with the Bureau of Land Management for many years because the ranch in Arizona was 70% BLM, so I was had a whole career of dealing with the Bureau of Land Management and knew quite a few people in the Bureau. And when we started, everybody was happy with everything and thought this was a good idea. But over time, the bureaucratic machine, if you would, makes some crazy decisions. And one of them, I'll tell you, this is in the book, but one of them, the first year, we had the horses out all summer, and we got them in. We'd keep them closer into the headquarters, and we put up 3,000 tons of hay each year. And we would feed the horses in December till almost May, you know, till April. We'd feed them and feed up the 3,000 tons. But we'd have them in close to the headquarters, and we had a bunch of big belts of trees there. So when a storm came, we'd put them in behind the trees and feed them there, and they'd get a lot of protection from the trees. Anyway, the first year when we got them in the fall, and I suggested this, I said, well, there's some older, thinner horses that are kind of nearing the end of their life. Why don't I cut maybe 50 of those out of the 1,500, and we'll double feed them all winter, but especially when we feed them, if they're in their own pasture, they won't have a lot of competition from the younger, stronger horses. You know, they won't get bumped around and when you feed. So the Bureau said, well, that's a good idea. So I cut out, I think it was 50 of the thinner horses and the old ones. When a horse gets ready to die, their system shut down and they get a little thinner and thinner, and pretty quick you can see the hip bones stick out and the ribs, and then pretty soon they die. So these horses were kind of on that track. And so that was fine. And we fed them all winter and put them back with the herd the next spring, and everything was fine. The next winter, the Bureau came and they said, well, we don't want you to give extra feed to the old horses this year. And I said, well, why not? I thought it was a good plan. They said, well, we want nature to take its course. And if it's their time to go, then it's their time to go. But we don't want you to give them any extra care. I kind of thought that was wrong, but anyway, I did it. You know, they owned the horses, and they were telling me what to do, so I did it. Third year, they came and they said, well, we want you to cut out the 25 oldest, thinnest horses that might not live through the winter, and we want to put them in the corral. We want to see them. So I did. And by the way, my training on the horses made it so easy to cut on them and, you know, cut some out or what all. They weren't panicked. They didn't try to crowd up and, you know, be hard to deal with. And so it was easy for me to do. So I had the 25 thinnest horses there. And Bill Crockford came, who was the representative, and he looked at them and he said, well, yes, these are the 25 thinnest. He went and looked at the main herd and then looked at these. And he said, yeah, these are the thinnest. Now I want you to kill them. And I had the same response I did just now. There's silence, you know. I didn't know what to say. And I said, well, Bill, my contract doesn't call for me killing horses. I'm their caregiver. I give them love. I don't kill them. He said, well, the boss tells me that he wants a 25, that life's not fun for them anymore, so he wants them killed. And I said, well, why don't you kill him? You've such a good idea. Why don't you kill him? He said, well, he said, I got to punch in the clock up at Sturgis, so I got to leave right now. Now, you kill these. And he got in his pickup and drove off. Well, should I go on? Well, not pretty. I never slept that night. I was awake all night, and I was making plans about where I could hide them, where they never would see them, or, you know, where I could tell them I killed them and leave the horses. And I wasn't going to ask one of my employees to do it, because I would never ask an employee to do something that I wouldn't do myself. And so the ball was squarely, the squarely in my hands. And I didn't sleep all night. And I went out the next morning and I killed him. And I'm not proud of that. Even today, I don't know what I should have done, what I could have done. It's just a black mark that I don't want to talk about it. It's something that will stay with me till I die. And they trusted me and they loved me, and we had this bond, and here I was standing right in the middle of them, shooting them one by one. And that is a gruesome thought. It's a gruesome scene. I just try not to think of it.
So at that point, connect the dots for me to when your ranching, your raising of horses, your caring for these horses ended.
Well, we started the conversation about, you know, how was it to deal with the BLM? And I said, well, they changed their policies and they make some decisions that I didn't agree with. And I was obviously not happy with that decision. And there were some others that were just didn't make much sense. And I don't know, it. I think the main thing was that the Oklahoma congressman said, you know, take that away from them and bring it to us. And so I could feel the shift in the BLM, you know, in my dealing with them. They were less friendly, less helpful. And I wasn't trying to fight them. I had contracted to do a service with them, and I delivered, you know, 105% of everything I agreed to. But things changed. And so eventually what they did is they said, well, we have to rebid this. And I said, well, why would you need to rebid? You can extend the contract, and you've come down and you inspect me every quarter, and I always get an A every time you inspect me. So why would you not continue? Well, we have to bid it. We have to bid it again. Oklahoma, they told me to deliver the bid on a certain day, and I did. And then they said, oh, by the way, we've put off the bid opening by 2 weeks. And I said, well, you called for me to bring the bids today. Can I leave them here? And they said, yes. Well, 2 weeks later, the people from Oklahoma underbid me by one penny. One penny. And they awarded it to the Oklahoma. And it cost them $80 a head for me to gather the horses, blood test them, vaccinate them, and ship them to Oklahoma so they could save a penny. Think I'm kidding? I'm not. That's pretty bizarre. Well, we flashed forward to the end of the book. That's the end of the book. The Wild Horse Sanctuary died on a whimper.
Is there anything that you'd like to add to this?
I didn't write the book as a beat-up on the government book. There are plenty of those, and there's plenty of room to do that. But I wrote the book because of my love of the horses and because of the really wonderful times that I spent with the horses. And because of the great response that the horses gave me back for, you know, for the time that I was with them. And that's what the book's about. And I loved that part of my life, and I loved being with horses. And so that's the note I want to end on.